We covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. It is the first of our Unitarian Universalist principles. Worth and dignity are actually two separate things, although we have a habit of conflating them, particularly in this context. The way I think about it, each person has worth and deserves dignity. In fact, one precedes and causes the other. We are each endowed with worth, and therefore we deserve to be treated with dignity. Inherent, of course, means that the worth is not ours to bestow. Each person has it simply because we exist. Like gravity, perhaps, this is a law of the universe. Because of our inherent worth, we have a right to be treated with dignity. This first principle is actually part of the covenant shared between Unitarian Universalist congregations. It is not, as such, then, a statement of our belief, though the idea of inherent worth and dignity, the assertion that everyone has value, is also found in Universalist theology, which preaches about the essential goodness of human beings. So while the first principle in and of itself is not a statement of belief, we as Unitarian Universalists do believe, because of our Universalist theological history, in the goodness and worth of human beings. Does that make sense? It's a little tricky. So when I was a kid, and maybe still today, there were posters on the walls in religious education classrooms that said, "We believe," and then they listed the seven principles, right? So we started thinking of the principles as statements of belief. They are not actually statements of belief, though some of us take our beliefs from the actions and understandings that come out of those seven principles. They are, in fact, promises that we make to each other and to other congregations about how we will treat each other. I, as a member of a Unitarian Universalist congregation, as a member of the larger denomination, will treat you, any one of you, members of the same, with dignity because of your inherent worth. We believe in the democratic process, all of those things. Though we have been teaching them as belief statements in many places, I do not believe that we should be teaching them as belief statements. Our beliefs, our theology, are the things that we believe and understand to be true, are different than the seven principles. Now, that is a slightly different conversation than the one that I want to have today. So let's put a pin in it. And we can talk in depth about the difference between covenant and belief statements and that on another occasion. But today I want to talk specifically about the first principle and that sense of Universalist understanding of the goodness and worth of human beings as a fundamental Unitarian Universalist belief. We believe that each person is important, that humans are inherently good. The first reading this morning articulates the problem with the statement, the principle. When we let it be only about goodness and sunshine, it is inadequate. How many of you have been a part of this conversation? You are speaking to someone outside of Unitarian Universalism who doesn't know who we are and what we believe, and you say, "We believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person." And they say, "What does that mean?" And you say, "Well, it means this to me, and it means that to me," and, you know, you have a nice description, and it makes sense. And then they say, "But what about Hitler?" Have any of you had that experience? Yeah, right? It happens all the time. But what about Hitler? Which is why that's what I call my sermon, because that is the question that this leads to, right? Okay, they say, I hear you, everyone is good, but what about Hitler? They're asking, if every human being is good and has value, what do we do then with people who choose to do bad things? So that's the question. Each time something horrible is done by an individual, we hear some variation of this challenge. I'm having such a hard time finding their inherent worth and dignity. In today's political landscape, I hear that struggle articulated fairly frequently. But in asking the question, how do I find their inherent worth, we are articulating the struggle. With the question, we express how challenging it feels to have to bestow worth upon a person when we know or we believe that they have done something awful. But that's what I feel. I feel like this is the good thing. The worth is not ours to bestow. We don't need to find it in our hearts to give inherent worth. Inherent means that it exists without me doing anything, without you doing anything, without anybody doing anything. Our work is actually to struggle with the ongoing practice of knowing and living as if everyone has worth. We have to wrestle with the difficulty of reconciling the experiences of evil and suffering throughout history and in contemporary life. If everyone is inherently good, then how do we end up with a Holocaust, with genocide, with all of the mean and horrible things that we do to each other? The concept of theodicy lies at the core of this question. In systematic theology, theodicy refers to the question of how a good God could allow evil and suffering to happen. It is the theological point on which Unitarian Universalism is widely dismissed. Because of our religious pluralism and the widely varying understandings of God, or lack thereof, that exist in our congregations, we don't always express a clear answer to the question of why evil and suffering happen and what we're supposed to do about it. The answer, having an answer to that question, is core to our relevance as a world religion, and it is the center of that struggle with the first principle and with universalism. We can believe that God doesn't exist. We can believe that God does exist and isn't in charge in the way that the Bible articulated. And those things can be true. But it doesn't make the concept of theodicy go away. It doesn't make us stop wondering why there is evil and suffering in the world. Because as human beings, understanding why something happens is part of how we find comfort in challenging times. And there's no easy answer here. There's no simple explanation. So for us as Unitarian Universalists, the question is not why does evil and suffering happen, but how do we interact with the fact that it does? What does it mean to be human and to have the capacity for both good and evil within us? Evil and suffering were not created by an outside force as a punishment, and that means that we are the ones who create it for one another. We are born good. Every person begins their life with innocence and the potential for good within them. We all live out this potential in small and large ways, and for most of us, it never gets to the level of a Hitler or a Pol Pot, or whoever is the latest mass shooter or lawmaker limiting basic civil rights. If we impose a limit on the worth of the people that we can identify as truly evil, it takes us to an unavoidable endpoint. It means that then there is a limit to our own worth. The problem with Hitler is that he was only a human being. He had power, and he had a set of reprehensible ideals. He was intelligent, and he believed wholeheartedly in what he was doing. But he broke the human covenant, and he perpetrated evil. Scott Alexander says, under certain painful, pernicious, and evil influences, the human heart and mind can be twisted and diminished in hideous ways that overpower and occasionally almost extinguish altogether that core of inherent worth, dignity, and decency with which we are all born. There are people who, under the crush of circumstance, formation, indoctrination, and personality, do grow up to act in evil ways. So the everyday work for you and me becomes a practice of reminding ourselves that, yes, Hitler did have worth. Under the crush of circumstance, he was twisted and diminished, and he chose to use his power and privilege to mobilize a nation to kill 11 million people. The everyday work is to see the worth of the people closest to us. The person who stole your parking spot, the neighbor who has a Confederate flag on their truck, to refuse to contribute to the circumstances that crush and diminish the human spirit. We must ask ourselves, how will I choose to use my own power? Will I keep the covenant of humanity and choose compassion? Will I be kind? Will I fight for justice, however I understand justice to exist? Because it isn't our job to bestow the worth on our fellow human beings. It's not our role. In fact, this is the hubris, I would argue, of the early American people who believed that they had the authority to say who was worthy and who was not. There is ongoing and vitriolic pushback against stating that Black Lives Matter. And this is part of this conversation about inherent worth as well. The fundamental reality underpinning the Black Lives Matter movement is that the entire political and social structure of the United States was built in a time when Black lives didn't just not matter. They were fundamentally understood to be less than. In this context, slaves were portrayed and treated as if they were animals, not human beings. Their inherent worth was systematically and intentionally denied. The dehumanization of an entire race happened because if you are a slaveholder and you admit that slaves are human, you have to accept that slaves have the same worth as you. And then, if you do that, you have to begin to grapple with the ethics of your choice to hold them as property and abuse them. This is the single most effective strategy of haters through the ages to dehumanize the enemy. It is, in fact, also what Hitler did. If you remove a person's worth, their humanness, then you can tell yourself that they don't need to be treated with dignity. It is the road to the concentration camp, the mass grave, and the urban riot gear-clad police officer. Dehumanization is the road to division and oppression. Our understanding of this concept stated in the first principle is not just a flip refrain. In practice, it is so much more than just we believe in the primacy of the individual. It articulates the fundamental struggle of being human. It is an ongoing practice of loving. It is the application of grace within our communal understanding of connectedness. It is precisely how we stay connected to complexity and how difficult life is. Because Hitler is not actually the hardest case. The dictators and the sociopaths are not the challenge. They seem the hardest to understand because their actions are the worst, the most reprehensible. In fact, they have little impact on our day-to-day lives because we can tell ourselves that we know that we won't ever be that evil ourselves. The hardest cases are those people who are closest to us. The hardest cases are the regular folks. And it is the circumstances and the people closest to us who create the systems that can twist us into evil or allow us to bloom in goodness. And we create those systems for the people closest to us. Like the monks in the story, when the rabbi told them that one of them was the Messiah, their behavior changed. They knew that if one of them was the Messiah, then they needed to be sure to be really, really nice to that person. We hear the challenge in the incredulous responses to the rabbi's statement. Could it be Brother William? Surely not. Could it be Brother John? Really? No. And yet, when the monks began to act as if everyone might be the Messiah, they became kinder to one another, and they got more connected. And as a result, their monastery grew and became known throughout the land. Because when you assign someone worth, you automatically treat them with dignity. Instead of focusing on the big bad dictators of history, we need to look into our day-to-day lives here and now. We need to understand the ways that we are called to see the humanity in each and every person we meet. We must dig deeper into working with Black Lives Matter. We must work to change the system so that every child, no matter what their race or class or gender, begins their life with the same opportunity. Because every child deserves the same opportunity to be loved and nurtured. Every child needs to learn how to manage their emotions, to be given food and shelter, to be encouraged. Every child deserves to be seen as the perfect, blessed, magical human being that they are, made of stardust and water and loved beyond measure. In order to do that, we must begin to see that every person could be the Messiah. Because every person is the Messiah in the sense that the Messiah is the one who will save the world. I say these words in every child dedication ceremony that I do. Each child is born one more Redeemer. We do not believe that God or Jesus or any other being from outside will come and save the world. We believe that human beings are the ones who will save us. That is our work as Unitarian Universalists, as human beings. Each child is born one more Redeemer. Each person is born with the tools to change the world, and we must give each child the loving support and sustenance so that they too can grow up knowing that they are worthy. And each parent must be treated with dignity as we acknowledge their humanity, their inherent worth, and work together to provide the tools to rebuild our communities. Because children who are raised to know their worth and manage their emotions become adults who are able to be kind, understand complexity, and have empathy. How many of you were not raised knowing that you had worth? And how many of you learned that for yourselves. I'm sure most of us are still working on it every single day. I know I am. Children who are raised to know their worth and manage their emotions become adults who are able to be kind, to understand complexity, and have empathy. And this is how the world changes. One person at a time, when we truly understand that each one of us is born one more Redeemer, we each have worth, and therefore we deserve dignity. May it be so.